Thank you, George Conrad. Heiner Müller says the past is the future. George Conrad says we are witnessing some kind of moralization of the memory. Is that a permanent process of repackaging the past? Isn't the art always relying on the past and using the past even when it is trying to make a radical break with this? Isn't the process of repackaging the past a permanent feature of any art? Isn't that something that has happened before and always has to happen, and not only now, Boris Groys?
Well, I would say that there is some kind of danger in thinking that what is happening in the politics, what is the political, it is real. It is a real life. And the art is some kind of reflection on it. I mean, we are living in a way in the world of some kind of not political theology, but of kind of theological politics. I mean, we believe in politics as the people earlier were believing in God. God was real, and now the politics is real and the art is reflection in it. But what is politics? Is an art of politics. And the politicians are also artists in this art of politics. And so for me, for example, the politics is a part of the art. And so the events of the art are for me much more substantial and real than the events in politics. And what is the events of the art which are for me substantial? It is some kind of loss of innocence or loss of virginity in the arts. I think we don't believe anymore, or at least I don't believe anymore, and many artists I know don't believe anymore, that the artist is some kind of a free medium, some kind of a free speaker, some kind of expressionist artist who just completely freely brings to the, I don't know, in the writing, or in the visual art, what he's really experiencing. I think now the art creation is much more reflective, non-innocent operation, very self-critical, self-reflective operation, very sensitive to the use of the images in the social context, much more sensitive to the idea of representation. And what is the politics? The politics is always a politics of representation, of democratic representation, of the socialist representation. And so some kind of disbelief into the representation is a possibility of expressing my own will or the collective will in some specific political system. And what we are witnessing now is a part of this story. I think it began in the arts. It began in the arts in the 19th century, this disbelief. And now this collapsing of the political systems is a result of it. And of course, there is some nostalgia for the innocence. And I think in the Eastern Europe, we are all experiencing this nostalgia from the innocence. It was the innocence of doing socialism. It was the innocence of opposing socialism. It was the innocence in being for that. It was the innocence of being against that. And now this innocence is lost. And there are some beautiful memories about this lost innocence. And it is a good art we can make out of it. But I think there is no innocence anymore. You can lost only once your innocence. And it is just lost.
I knew you would react to that. Go ahead.
Apart from conjuring up some money out of your pocket, maybe, but that may be only. I don't
don't think that it's so helpful to see. It's also the line of one of the big mistakes of the 60s and of maybe our century, to equate, to say everything, everybody is an artist, which is to me very questionable, because why is not everybody a maker? What is so special about artists? Politicians and artists, why is not a politician a scientist? What do we look up for in the arts that we think that is more maybe the highest thing in the world or something? It is a craft, it is a profession, it is something to work hard on. You have, as I said, you have false artists, in my opinion. You have chemical artists. You have here, just, if you equate artists and politicians, and I don't know whether you have seen our contribution in Amsterdam to the 20th century architecture, it's called the Stover. That is a combination of artist and politician. It's a bit it's a monster, I can assure you. It's the wrongest building there is in this country. It is very dangerous. Politicians are typical for their craft. I mean, I remember Einstein's last interview. He was asked, Maestro, how come that the human race is so clever that it can make the atom bomb and it cannot make peace? And then Einstein said, and it made me feel a bit humble also. Einstein said, yes, you know, politics is so much more difficult than science. That is a helpful thing, to think of a special talent, a special field of solution of problems of power that is really a craft. And we should not act as artists like politicians, and the politicians should not act as artists.
Maybe one short remark. I think there's a difference between baker and artist, and there are much less difference between a politician and artist, because politician and art are about the representation and expression. You can eat what a baker made, but you cannot eat parliament, and you cannot eat a picture. A picture is just there. And so it's about expressing our will, our personal will, our collective will, and there are different modes of expression this will. They are always, all of them are somehow connected, because it is always a problem, what is useful, what is not useful, what is true, what is false, and it is interconnected in some other very intimate way for me.
To allow artists to be in politics. For instance, when the Academy in Vienna accepted Hitler as a painter, he would have been a bad painter, but it doesn't matter. There are bad painters. But, you know, I mean, it's quite dangerous. And we need mediocre people in politics. They are trustworthy. They may be idiots, but it's better to have an atheist in the leading position in politics than a genius. okay. What I want to say is reflector actor. Remember, there's the anecdote about Brecht standing with one of his assistants in the theater and looking at the public coming in, and the assistant asked him, is this what you did here? It was the Caucasian shock circle. Is this epic theater in your sense? And he said, no, it can't be epic theater, because epic theater in my sense is possible only when the perversity stops to make a profession out of the pleasure. I think we should maybe talk a bit about the new definition of art and of artists. and not, for instance, with this video things. Everybody can be an artist. Maybe this is a danger for artists, but it's a question we should discuss.
But it gives a possibility to make some kind of artistic criticism of politics. I think you do it. You do it because I think you are very sensitive in your work to this artistic dimension of politics and to the possibility for the artist to see the political work as an artistic work and to deal with it in this way. It's a very interesting possibility.
Because there are two things. First of all, it's a bit short-sighted to say that you can eat bread and you cannot eat art. Art is a food for the soul. If you say that everybody can make that food, we have this
no, not
terrible example here.
Do you feel that threatened in your field of art? Do you feel the need to engage in some kind of turf protection as to delineate your artistic work from something that you see as bad art or commercial art or pseudo art? Do you see that these boundaries are clear or that they have to be drawn and redrawn? What is your attitude about that?
Everything is in the place.
Everything is
in the place. You read and do. Everything is in it. So it's only interpretation on the time. So the time is reflecting in the place in how you reflect the play. So the performance is the real discussion for me.
Of the play.
Yes, the performance. The form of this this production. So everybody is doing Heiner Müller in a different way.
Yes, it's Heiner Müller and witness.
And there is always a discussion: is it political theater or is it or not? So it's both or not. So how you reflect it. So in every sentence, in every play, there is much politic. There is politic in it, but you can do it on your artistic way. You can do it naive, or you can reflect it on another way than only a political discussion. It's an artist is reflecting. Only reflecting, and he has a certain taste, and you can say he is good or bad or on the wrong side or something, but everything is in it.
And Andrei Bitov, as I understand, in Russia there is an explosion of new playwrights, many new authors, but are they really trying to come to terms with the rapidly changing reality of what used to be known as Soviet Union, or they are trying to invent an art that will be a territory on its own, that will be distanced and removed from what has been the social, the collective experience of the last few years or last 75 years? How do you see this attitude?
You see, I don't see it at all. It's just a mistake. It happened like that I don't know theater at all. Once in 1944, I've seen one performance, and I was so frightened that I have a kind of... I'm crazy about visiting theater.
You told me this story.
Yes. I don't know what is happening in Shakespeare's times, in our times, but I think that there is some reasons for bad feelings for theater people and for playwrights, because, we have a lot of theaters alive, yes? For instance, Central Committee Theater, and then KGB theater was opened at last, and we are all inside of this great theater coming, and it was it was prepared for a long period. It was hard work for 70 years to have these closed theaters, and they are all opened to conquer this new information for public. It's quite impossible. And therefore, and also the usage of money, because it was state theaters, they were paid, and some of them managed to be more or less avoiding all this socialist, realist ideological pressure, and working with it at the same time, and they had some strange room. And now, being on open air without any, even this falling ruble is absent, they are just reflecting what is happening with them, and not more. All attempts to become more real, more present, more authentic, showing the moment, it's all failure. It can't work in any time. It's not even the question of the artist. I wonder whether they are so frightened if they are and they are looking for it, what you ask. Then it's a real failure of the whole theater.
And what do you think, Hannes Böhringer? Do you feel, Heiner Müller said in the interview, perhaps the first man was an artist, but then the second man on the earth was an economist. And he has drawn a few minutes ago again our attention to the importance of money when we discuss art, that a discussion of art cannot go on without consideration of money issues. That's of course something we do all the time. But do you feel that this whole emergence of a mass marketed art is substantially changing the perspectives of artistic development? Is the dynamics of artistic innovation substantially changed? Is it accelerated?
Yes, I think so. I think since perhaps 15 years ago, there is a real blow up and boom in visual art, and there is a lot of lot of money in this sector. But and in the beginning, all the artists were very excited by this new situation, and it was a new situation that an artist, a young artist, perhaps 25 years old, could earn a lot of money within few months. This was absolutely a new experience. But now I think the situation has normalized. And I feel that the artists in West Germany, they can live with this situation that some artists earn a lot money and the others don't earn so much, are rather poor, but they can handle it. But now I feel that the artists who come from East Germany or from East Europe, they talk a lot of money now, and it's because for them it's a new experience, of course. Mm-hmm.
For me, one aspect of this problem is that censorship is refining style, the way of writing. But commercial censorship doesn't. It's corrupting the working morals of artists. That's one problem, I mean. Especially maybe in visual arts, but in literature too. There's no reason to write a good sentence if you can sell the sentence which is not well written. That's a big problem now. I feel it when I see text plays of young writers, that they want to be fast, they want fast money, and it doesn't matter if it's a good text. A good text is gets you not more money than a bad text. And that's one aspect of this new.
Well, but in this point, I'm very conservative. I think that spirit is always stronger than money.
Yeah, but many Eastern European artists or writer, even if it sounds cynical, will claim indeed that the censor in the old days was a friend and an ally, someone who made the pressure to. An ally in a sense that it made, demanded this extra effort.
Okay.
Hmm?
Co-author?
Yeah. Maybe yeah. There's another dimension in this story, and I'm personally very sensitive to this dimension. You know, every political system has its own outlook, has its own aesthetic expression, I would say. There's a problem of the relationship between high art and culture market. But I mean, the Western democratic capitalist market system has its own aesthetic face as a system. It's not Dutch, it's not German, it's not American, it's not French. But if you're going through the Western Europe, you see this face, yes? You see this aesthetic dimension, you can recognize it immediately. It has some aesthetic quality as a whole. And for example, the Soviet system had a different face, different music, different face expression in the crowd, different classing, different pictures, always different, or Nazi Germany, for example. I mean, every political system and market system or socialist system has this aesthetic dimension. And for example, now for me, it's very strong aesthetic experience to go to Moscow and to see how this old Soviet aesthetics, Soviet aesthetic phase is combined with the Western. It's really a monstrum. It's like a, like this incredible postmodern artwork, the whole Moscow. Maybe it disappears in 2 or 3 years, but now it's a very strong feeling and strong aesthetic experience, and I think the artists can deal with it and can work with it, and many artists are doing it very effectively.
Hmm. There is another dimension I want to bring in before we take a break, and that is, again, in the same interview, you say, Heiner Müller, does, the original trauma of our civilization is the mixture of languages, the loss of one common basis of understanding. This is especially felt by us who belong to the small nations and small languages, with the Dutch, with the Yugoslavs, with the Hungarians. And even if the circumstances have changed politically in Europe considerably, even though we talk of one Europe or open Europe or a large Europe, that remains a considerable limitation. As an author who writes in Hungarian language, but is published, fortunately, abroad in many languages, how do you see that, George Cornett?
It's a slow process. I feel that works which are really valuable, if they are not very difficult to translate, will find somehow the way to the foreigner readers. And it's also a question how slow and how gradual is the expansion of the West European or world market toward the East European artistic works. It seems to me that from my country, many of my colleagues are translated, and those who are the most appreciated in Budapest are also somehow published in and invited in other countries. I believe also that the fact that small nations with their national languages, knowing that they cannot communicate in their own languages, will somehow learn the other, it gives a possibility. And it's not so terrible if people don't have so many readers or so big audience, because finally, the small audience is also an important one. Moni, I feel that somehow I was more, theoretically, it's more probable that, for example, young writers now try to make a kind of commercial literature because they can get more money with it. But somehow the facts doesn't speak about that. There are some people who aren't actually writers, who are maybe geographers or house lady, or one of them is a lawyer, another is a librarian, and they are making under funny names, so such kind of English-made names, some criminal novels and such kind of very, very low-level commercial novels. These are amateurs and they make their decent works every 3 months, a novel, and it will be sold in 100,000 or at least 70,000 copies. So it's a métier, a craftsmanship, and probably none of the good young writers would be able to do that. Their vocabulary is really very restrained, and always the most simple solutions, but sometimes it works. But those who find that they are writers, they have some other references, and actually the fact that they are more more complex or closed or difficult to understand, or this is not really important in the number of the copies, and good writers can achieve in Hungary so 10,000, maybe a little bit more, and this is not enough for being rich, not enough for living from it, and somehow, but even those who are the less accessible have the possibility to publish somehow their work and somehow to sell it. So the literature became a kind of not really economically oriented activity, and those who want to have quick money will not write novels.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Because I find it a bit bottom side to be the attention to only verbal language. There are more languages. There is the visual, the body language, and there is above all the musical language. And there is no language, so that is the common language of our planet. If you see what the effect is, we always have a Louis, we as official artists. It covers two things at the same time, the common language and the economy. Because if you want to get rich, you must start a successful pop group. And you know that one of the richest people are the rock musicians, the successful rock musicians. But they use a language which was invented one day. I mean, you can even trace it. You can see that the musical language that was forbidden by the dictators, invented by Khomeini and by Brezhnev, etc., etc. That language that liberated so many people, that brought a whole culture as an oil slick of the world, that language was formalized and invented in the 18th century. It was after one century of preparation. It was formalized theoretically by Philippe Jean-Philippe Rameau. And it is still the language, the harmonic musical language, that the whole pop music uses, without really knowing that they do, but it has become a national language, and that it has sunk into the subconscious, and that is an incredible feat of the musical culture. I may remember that how dangerous music can be was already apparent in 400 BC, when there was this optional musician, Timotheus, in Greece, and he expanded his guitar from 7 strings to 11. He used 4 more tones, and he raised big audiences to a form of ecstasy that became politically dangerous and it was prohibited. And he was forced by the government to take out these 4 extra notes again. That quality has always been a musical quality. Music has always had this power to work under the iron curtains of official policies, dictatorial policies. And I want to stress that. Not forget that.
Yeah, thank you for broadening, in a way, taking away our focus on linguistic language, and indeed, we've been dealing with visual arts a bit, and on linguistic language primarily, so the language of sound has been missing. Would you be inclined that we take a break now? I see a lot of nods in the audience. Please use that break not only to go to the bar and have something to drink, but also please put pieces of papers here.